session number 23447, reel 9.
Mr. Waller, reel 9. We got to the point where you were advancing through the desert in pursuit of the Germans after the Battle of El Alamein in October, sort of early November 1942.
True.
And any incidents you remember from the advance?
No, it was really just go, try. They were, shall we say, withdrawing, and we were chasing them. And all that happened, there were no fixed battles as such, except that every now and again, at a certain point, they might stop and put up a defensive screen with 88 anti-tank anti-tank guns and tanks and fire at you to hold you up. But it wouldn't last long, you know, it might be half a day or something like that, and then they'd pack up and start going. So it was all short, sharp engagements going on there.
What did you think of the 88? I mean, that was quite getting...
Oh, deadly.
Well, I mean, it was originally anti-aircraft, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What did you think of the way they used it?
Brilliant. I mean, you could see... they used to set up... You didn't see them, but they set up an anti-tank screen. I mean, our tanks would go out there and bang, 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 you'd lose 50 tanks just like that because our tanks would never get within range. And they just knock them all out, and that was the main factor, that our tanks could never get in within range of the 88s.
So that was what was so good about it, the range.
Yeah.
Anything else particularly good about the 88?
It was an absolute winner as far as the tank battle was concerned. You see, they just dropped them in position, and that was it. I certainly wouldn't like to have been a tank man, shall we say, despite the problems that we had personally. But
so what's the next thing you remember then? You know, the advances going on.
Yeah.
Through North Africa.
Yeah, and it was more or less like that. I'm trying to think where the first real, when I say battle, was compared to a sort of holding action, or a short holding action, but... I'll be quite honest, I can't really remember but it seemed to be fairly, you know, it was short, sharp actions, and it seemed to be a jolly ride up. We just kept going all the time once they got on the move, because in the desert, there's not many places where you can stop and form a defensive line, you know. I mean, you can say, oh, we've got to withdraw, but you're talking of 100, 200 miles, you see. If it's all open, if you stop, you can be outflanked. So once you start running, it's like the most of the desert war was up and down, because there were such long distances before you actually came to a position that you could hold.
How were you supplied during the advance? Because that's quite complicated.
Well, I mean... I don't know about from base upwards, but I mean, the system we had was, you had A echelon, which was your main one, picked up from division. That they brought it up to B echelon, and then B echelon would come up to at night usually, and come up to us, you might say, the frontline troops, and they would bring up the water tanker would come up, and the quartermaster with the rations and ammunition and so forth.
So, and it always worked as far as you were
concerned? Well, you know, if there was something going on, by that, I mean, I can remember our lads picked up, I think it was either Italian or German motorbike, which the silencer had gone on it, so that when it went, you know, it made... And the... quartermaster was bringing the stuff up, and he heard this damn motorbike and thought it was machine gun fire, so he turned around and went back. So we ducked out on ration for 48 hours. So we got rid of the motorbike. But, you know, basically it worked quite well. Yeah, sometimes, you know, they might come up and So we'll be up for, usually it was a full 48 to 72 hour load up time, but sometimes something might happen and you get a delay, but basically it worked very well. We all, you know, we didn't sort of starve. In any case, you always carried emergency rations on board, you know, so many tins of bully beef and biscuits, you always carried them on there, and a reserve of water, so many cans of water, just in case they didn't get out there in time. In that case, you got the orders to break out the emergency rations.
Now, what's the next thing you remember then? I know, you know, you don't remember actions one by one, but...
No. No, I really, it was just, I say, apart from these short, sharp actions that were going on, it was no-ending drive we seemed to be on, you know. You sort of went on and on and, you know, past Mersham of Truth, past Tobruk, and up the Bengali, and it was the hold-ups. Oh, we got held up twice. Once, well, we hit what was we thought was a minefield. It was supposed to be one of ours. It turned out to be a dummy minefield, but it held us up for 48 hours before anybody found out.
What do you mean the W? Can you just explain a bit?
Yeah, well, sometimes they do that. You put the barbed wire up, and if you haven't got enough mines, you see, you might put one or two old ones, but basically you use any metal plate, anything, put down and make out it was a minefield, you see. Well, you can't take a risk, so you have to wait for the engineers to come up and sweep the area, the gap. It was it was an emergency measure. If you were short of mines and that, you create a dump, what I call a dummy minefield, you know, a bit of barbed wire, hang a notice on Acton Min and Willis, and that was it. And then there was the winter rain came down, and it really only happens for a few days, but it poured down, and the vehicles were just slipping and sliding all over the place. And it brought us, the whole column, the whole division, more or less to a standstill. And I can remember thinking, I can have a bath. And there were slit trenches and they were full of water. And I jumped into one and I went blue and nearly froze to death. I thought it was going to be weird, because it used to be in the desert. It's strange. You get it hot during the day and at night you're sitting around a fire with an overcoat on. And so... But it was a comparatively easy ride, and, you know what I mean?
So where did it come to an end? I mean, what's the next big thing? Through Benghazi?
Yeah. And I'm trying to think how far up there was the Barath line, I know, but I think there was Wadi Akrit before that. But... being an armour division, this was left to the heavy infantry, and the armour tended to try and get round, you see. But eventually when we got up to, before that we started getting into what I call cultivated area. In other words, you were going through Libya, they've got a green strip, and you were getting Libya coming up to the Tunisian border. And they had the olive groves there. And I can remember there there was quite a tank battle on, because we had a new white kneed officer out from England, and we were moving up, and he said to us, "I want you to go and support that tank out there, give it covering fire." And I said, "Well, it's not a good idea, because it's a Mark IV. "Oh, no, it isn't." He said, I know my tank recognition. And I said, "I'm sorry, but," I said, "I've been doing this job a long while." I said, "That's a Mark IV. And one of the lads got a pair of binoculars he'd picked up and looked through. He said, "Not only is it a Mark IV, but it's got a big black cross on the side of it." And there was a little bit of a fracas. I had a man Friday. He was one of these characters from the East End of London, who'd done two stretches in Pentonville Prison, had a razor scar down his face to back it. Most peculiar character, didn't give a monkeys for anybody. Never got paid while he was in the army because he was married, or had been married with two children, had left his wife, was living with another woman and had children by her. So his allowances he had to make for the families came to a shilling a day more than his army pay. And this went on during the whole of his service. And what they used to do was they kept paying this out. And when he got £50 in debt, they used to write it off and start again. And this went on for 6 years. They actually solved it 3 months after he was demobbed. But he was one of these characters. The only time he got paid is if he was put in the guardhouse or in the prison or whatever. And under King's regs, you had to be allowed money for his toothpaste soap. So he didn't really give a damn, and he said to his officer, "Don't be a silly little bugger," and promptly got 28 days for that. there was quite a battle. They were moving around by the olive groves. Quite a tank battle going on there. We were there for support, firing at the tanks. Wasn't getting better. The main concentration of fire was being made on our tanks rather than your sort of four anti-tank guns. They weren't particularly bothered about them. It was the tanks were mobile, so they wanted to stop them. And then we kept moving till we got to the Marath line, and that was essentially heavy infantry. So they took the 7th Armoured, the 4th Indian and the New Zealand divs and sent them on a left hook round Marath to go down towards Tunis. And the run through Tunis, would run to Tunis was quite light, the amount of firing we did, it was very light, it was...
Did you actually go through the mountains?
Had you
go through the mountains? There's a mountainous area.
Yeah. No, well, they were on our... We weren't going over the mountain passes or anything. We made our way on the flat country and then ran round and joined up with the First Army, who took a very poor view of us by that time, I think we were on about our 5th or 6th vehicle that had been knocked out. By that time, we had a 30-hundred weight, which was towing the gun, the anti-tank gun, and everything was chucked on, and we were absolute scruff order. Old, dirty old smoke cans on the back, that had been brewing up, and they were all trotting around in blankoed belts and gaiters, and they looked down on their nose ass. And
what had happened to the truck? The other times that had been.
We hit on a rocky patch, and that broke the springs. That was the last portee we had, and after that, we then got a thirty hundred weight. Open, no canopy, and threw everything in, and we towed the gun in, which on the little wheels it had, it wasn't really good for it, but that was the only way we could manage, and we got along there, and then we went over a bloody mine, which is one of the reasons I suffer still today. Front wheel caught it. So the blast was concentrating there, but we all went up in the air, and of course you've got these metal boxes of ammunition, and came down on them, and it was very painful. So That was, we lost one with, one broke down, one broke its springs, one we went over a mine. We didn't lose any through enemy action, shall we say. It was all, the sort of thing you got with the mine business. We were going to, following a pattern, and they said, oh, we think there's mines about, so keep in the tracks of the vehicle in front. And which we were doing, but the cunning Deutschers had used mines which they could set, and it would allow five vehicles to go over it, and on the sixth one it would go up. And I remember our water carrier was driving along, and he went over it, and the chap driving it, I suppose he would have been what, mid-30s. We all called him Pop because we were sort of 21, 22, you know, that age. And he was, he was actually married, you know, and got dentures and all this, you know, thinning hair. And we used to call him Pop. And he drives along and goes over a mine, and everybody rushes up, and he's mowing away. They pull him out and they lay him down. And the rations hadn't caught up with us. We hadn't had any cigarettes for about 3 weeks, you see. And he said, oh, he said, anybody got a cigarette? And somebody said, yeah, I've got my last one. And gave it to him and lit it. And the MO came up and he looked at me and said, oh, you got a nasty bang on your head. We hit the roof. He said, but your leg, you just banged it on the steering wheel. He said, you're all right. The bloke said, you cheeky bugger, give me a cigarette back. Took it off him, you know. Greater love had no man to give his last cigarette to a wounded comrade. So, but yeah, you came across patches like that. But these were mostly old minefields, you see. This was from months previously, previous battles, and they laid them, you know. You couldn't necessarily bypass them because it may have been too soft the sand to get through, so you had to contend with this and where the old minefields were.
And what's the next thing? You'd met the First Army.
Yeah, we got round there and we began to come across Americans because they used to come up when we stopped at night, League It Up or Log It Up, they used to come round asking us if we had any souvenirs. They all wanted Lugers and Berettas and were offering packs of American cigarettes for them, you know. So, because they were the rear echelon troops. So they used to come round and try and buy them off you. And we went down and...
What did you think of the Americans?
Didn't give it much thought, really. Thought it a bit odd that somebody was willing to buy things like Lugers off you, you know, and belts with Gottmittens on them, you know. We had thousands of them virtually, you know, couldn't be bothered to pick them up. But we didn't get involved over, we were in Kasserine Pass or anything. We weren't over that side. We were making direct for Tunis, and the Germans were withdrawing all the time. And I know I think it was the cherry pickers, the Lumpf Hussars of our division, they got into Tunis first, and then we got in. And there was a little bit of odd sniping going on, but nothing much. And we got in there, and on the way up, before we got there, some Germans had surrendered. We'd stopped and they came out to us and started trying to speak, and I gathered that one of their comrades had been wounded, so we went out to find him, and he was propped up against a tree and been wounded across the stomach. So we loaded him up, we pulled the door off his shed and got him on that, got him back, took him to the ambulance, and they saw him. And it was after they'd gone, I thought, well, I'd better go back and check there's no weapons laying around. Went back, and his jacket was still there. And So I thought, we'll have a look in that, you know, and he had his wallet and it was full of Tunisian money notes, you know. So I thought, well, he won't want that in hospital, so I decided to liberate it. And his pay book was also in it, and I asked, one didn't take that because that was his means of identification, but there was nothing I can do. He'd gone then by the ambulance and we were on the move. So I still have that to this day. So, but the money, well, what happened, I didn't find out until later. We got this, I had all this money, so when we got into Tunis, I said to Bill Ash and one of the other lads, I said, well, we better go and spend this. So we went out and bought crates of wine, went in the park and sat down and enjoyed it thoroughly. The next day, nobody would take the money because the Germans had been forging it and bringing it over here, because the first day, nobody had sort of tumbled it, so we managed to spend all ours on wine. And and then we moved on from there to towards Cap Bon, where they were trying to evacuate them by sea and by plane. And we sat down in a line, and we were firing more or less at extreme range with our six-pounders just into the Cap Bon area. It was more firing in hope rather than in direct targets. You couldn't really see them. We were too far back. But I always remember a German came in. I don't know what his rank, but I think he must be an officer. He came forward to surrender and spoke perfect English. Said he'd been to Cambridge University. And he said, you know, so and so. We got talking and we said, oh, yeah, we were 8th Army. We'd come up from sort of Cairo, from Alamein. And he said, oh, no, it's impossible. He wouldn't believe us at all. He said, no, 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 it's not possible. You couldn't have. I said, well, you can believe us or not, but I think it came as quite a surprise to them that the 8th Army had got so far, you know. And so they, more or less, suddenly everything came to an end, you know. It sort of...
It's been about April 1943.
Yeah.
April, May.
April, May, yeah. So we were then... We were persona non grata with the 1st Army. We were a lot of scruffy soldiers. So we got sent back to Homs, about 30 kilometres from Tripoli. And we were down on the coast there. And we were issued for the first time with a little one-man bivouac.
What were they like? Can you describe them?
Well, it's a small tent thing, you know, like a small one-man tent. And what you did, there was no height in them. So what you did, you dug a square hole in the sand and put it over the top of it so that you could stand up inside. And you also carved the sand out so that there was like a bunk of sand and you laid on top of that, you know, you laid your ground sheet and... blanket on top of that to sleep on. The only trouble was we were right near the beach, and what we didn't know, that hundreds of these sort of green crabs used to come out at night, and they were all coming up to our tents or bivouac and suddenly falling down the holes which we'd dug. And so we suddenly woke up to find you had about 20 or 30 crabs all crawling and fall down your holes. So after that, we used to have to get sandbags and build them up outside to stop the crabs coming in. And it was then a question of quietly, you know, going swimming, cleaning yourselves up.
Was there a proper rest period, or was it?
I mean, when the war was, you know, the war out there and finished, so there was no action. And there was no real training going on. I mean, they just said everybody thought that we were either going back to the Delta for leave or going home. That was what they thought. Anyway, there was this didn't happen, and they said, we were all called out on parade. And, you know, the grapevine gets working, the Bush Telegraph. And they said, we're not going back. Something's happened. And everybody was called out on parade, and the majority of them, which you could hear the bolts clicking on the rifles and things. Everybody went out with their weapons, you see. And the brigadier was saying, now, just listen to me. Don't do anything stupid. You know, you could see that almost a mutiny was brewing because they really thought they were going up back to the Delta or going home. And then just about had enough. So anyway, they said, no, what we'll do, you've got to be patient till we get things sorted out. But in the meantime, we're going to, the Army Welfare Services will be taking over and they'll have a rest camp. What they meant was they were going to set up a sort of canteen and a few tents in the desert, which didn't go down well. But then they said, well, we have other things. We're going to open a cinema. So they said, right. And we went along to the cinema and they showed Desert Victory, which didn't go down very well. I think the next night the lads went up with petrol cans and set light to the cinema.
What was it about Desert? What was it about Desert Victory? Did you see it? What did you think of it?
It was all right, but having spent the last 2 to 2.5 years in the desert and Alamein and all that sort of thing, the last thing you wanted for amusement was to see Desert Victory. You know. So, I mean, we had a cinema once before when we got into Tunisia. And they had an American film, Hells Are Popping, and that was funny. You could enjoy it, but, I mean, to go and see Desert Victory, no. And then some
bright... Did they really burn it down, or was that just a rumour?
Oh, yeah, they tried to, yeah. Whether they burnt it completely, I don't know. I mean... when things like that happen, you keep clear, you see. Don't know anything about it, you see. Don't get involved. And then somebody decided that they got this Italian gentleman who said he could bring a mobile brothel down, which, I can't remember, it was, what, 2 vans. I didn't, not that I took advice of his services, but... I knew for Brendan, he had a big roll of tickets, you know, a little tear of tickets, shilling tickets. And he got there, but there were 6 girls, and there was a division. Now, division is what? 3,000 men? And there was outside these two things, there was a long snake-like crew going, disappearing into the desert. If a couple of Messerschmitts had come over, they could have wiped the division out, all queuing up outside these mobile brothels. So after 3 days, they left. I think the six girls were completely knackered, and they left and went away. And after that, the Army Welfare Services opted out, and we were left to our own devices, and we were... really spent the time going swimming. We were out near the coast, we were swimming in the sea and rigged up a net and playing with quoits, you know, throwing the ball over. And we were more or less left to our own devices. No, there was nobody sort of organised much training. There was a little bit that went on, but it was all very relaxing. And we carried on.